for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama's mother, S. Ann Dunham, an economic anthropologist, completed her doctoral dissertation in 1992. It was based on 14 years of research among rural craftsmen in Indonesia, and she hoped to have it published. Now, 14 years after her death, that goal has been realized. It's titled Surviving Against the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia. Her daughter, President Obama's half-sister, Maya Sutoro Eng, joins me in the studio to talk about her mother's life, her work, and her legacy. You can join us as well, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Before I begin our conversation with Maya, I do want to welcome our new listeners at WGBH in Boston. I welcome you to the program and invite you to join in the conversation, 800-433-8850. Good morning to you, Maya. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you, Diane. It's really good to be here.
You, I gather, were very instrumental in getting your mother's dissertation published. Tell us about that process.
Actually, Diane, my big confession is that I was not particularly instrumental in getting my our mother's dissertation published. What I did was I handed over three volumes amounting to about 1,000 pages to Alice Dewey, who was the head of my mother's doctoral committee. And I said, Alice, here are some photos, here are some floppy disks, here's the dissertation. Mom always wanted it published. How about you take a look at it now that you're retiring and see what you can do to edit it from 1,000 pages to something a little more digestible.
Down to something like 325.
That's correct.
Whoa! Quite an editing job.
It was. And so she embarked on that process. In order to get the dissertation uploaded onto her computer, she had to transfer the material from these floppy disks, which are no longer used. And she actually asked our friend Nancy Cooper, also in the University of Hawaii Anthropology Department, to assist her in that endeavor. And it was the two of them then who really figured out what to take away, what to add, what information was still relevant, and what to hone in on. And they also are the ones who got the attention of Ken Wissaker at the Duke University Press.
Did she leave any instructions as to how she wanted it done?
No, not beyond telling me that she felt that the dissertation would be useful for those who are interested in rural credit programs, in microfinance. People were experiencing a sort of burgeoning interest in that at the time of her passing, and she was in fact supposed to return to Indonesia and get microfinance programs developed throughout the archipelago at the time of her illness. She felt like there were parts of her dissertation that would continue to be relevant for a long period of time. Unfortunately, she didn't tell me which parts, which is because it's not my field. That's why I left it to Alice and then subsequently Nancy to determine.
You know, it's so interesting because thinking back, we heard a great deal about microfinance from then Senator Hillary Clinton when she was in office. And she really brought that to the fore. But from what you are saying and from your mother's doctoral dissertation, it sounds as though she was quite involved with that early on.
She was quite involved. Now, the dissertation is not about microfinance
right.
per se, but what she does do in the latter parts of the dissertation, and I know this because I recently reread it, is she makes the assessment that rural banking programs had a much greater impact than government development initiatives did. And she talked a little bit about the power of the NGO, and she sort of contemplated the impact of deregulation rather, and mechanization, as well as an appropriate government response to the market and the behavior of international business partners. So she sort of took a look at what was taking place in village industries in a very broad way and left the door open to a continued interpretation and negotiation and so that people might develop an understanding about how to move forward. And so microfinance was a small part of that. But in terms of her work, what she was doing with Bank Rakyat Indonesia, the People's Bank, and Women's World Banking and other organizations, she was very much involved in microfinance.
Maya Sotero Eng, we're talking about her mother's dissertation titled Surviving Against the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia. Her mother, of course, was S. Ann Dunham. Her first name was actually Stanley, but Maya, you said she got a lot of kidding about that first name.
That's right. She was named after our grandfather.
I see.
Stanley, who was in the war at the time of her birth, who did come home to see her. And when she was younger, I think she sort of took the nickname Stanny, and then as an adult decided to go with Anne, her middle name.
And Maya, this doctoral dissertation covers 14 years of her research, minus the kind of editing that was done of her 1,000 pages. It began in 1976. Tell us where you were then.
I was a child living with her in Yogyakarta in Central Java. We had just returned from Hawaii. We lived in Honolulu from 1973 to 1976 with my brother, our president. And then our mother, having finished her master's degree, decided that she wanted to go back to Indonesia, in part to try to make her marriage to my father work, but also to make use of much of her learning. And so we returned to Jogja, and it was at that point that my brother started living with our grandparents, her parents, in Hawaii.
So you went with her, but your brother, the president, stayed with the grandparents.
In Hawaii, that's
in
correct.
In Hawaii. What was your life like?
Well, it was very interesting. So the dissertation is about blacksmithing, but she also worked in a lot of other kinds of villages that attended to other cottage industries. We went to places where they worked with bamboo and clay. I went to tile-making villages and brick-making villages, silver-working carpets, and, of course, to blacksmithing villages. The dissertation is actually largely about Qajar, and they worked with tools and implements, metal tools and implements. But I remember most clearly The villages where they would make the kris, they would make the sword or the dagger, the kris, K-E-R-I-S. Those were extraordinary places. And I would do my homeschooling in the morning. And
so
I did,
you were homeschooled the entire time?
The entire time until middle school, yes.
Now,
and then she would take me to the villages.
Place Qajar for us within Indonesia.
It is in central Java. It is south of Yogyakarta, which is Jogja, as its more familiar name. I think that it's to the south, but, you know, I haven't actually looked on a map recently. Our mother would often get there by motorcycle, on the back of a motorcycle.
And you?
Or a truck.
You would go with her?
Sometimes I would join her there. Sometimes I would stay in Jogja. And we had neighbors and family members and others who would take care of me, and I would often do my studies at home. But she did take me to the field. I, in fact, later, before moving to Hawaii again at the age of 14, would be given the camera, and I took a great many pictures when she was doing research for Ford Foundation.
So you had both homeschooling and in the field experience. Maya Sutero Eng. We're talking about her life, her mother's dissertation titled Surviving Against the Odds. We're talking about the dissertation of President Barack Obama's mother, S. Ann Dunham. It's titled Surviving the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia. S. Ann Dunham's daughter is with me. She is the half-sister of President Barack Obama. She is Maya Sutero Eng. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I would gather that the people in the villages that your mother went to visit and research became friends.
Definitely. I mean, I think the reason the dissertation is good is that she refused to swallow simplistic assessments of the people, of their craft, of the community. And she reveals a great deal of respect for the people. Her language shows us that she empathizes. And I've always said that that's one of the things that she gave to my brother, is that sort of optimism in the face of a lot of pessimism. But it's an optimism that doesn't sort of dismiss the real difficulty of the tasks at hand. And there were substantial difficulties in villages in a non rice cultivation villages, cottage industry villages in Indonesia. There was real poverty, but there was also a great deal of possibility, and that's why the title of the dissertation, Surviving Against the Odds, is so important. I think that, you know, these larger industries are too often in the hands of the few, and yet the agricultural sector, the rice farmers, that's not enough to sustain the many, particularly because whether pushed or pulled, the farmers moved a lot to the cities. So if you're going to think about the health of a nation, I think you have to consider the well-being of these rural industries.
Considering the fact that she was able to transmit that sense of positive thinking to both your brother and to yourself, you've said she was somebody who was never limited by fear or narrow thinking. Tell us about her personally and your relationship with her personally.
Well, a lot of what she gave us is what every good mother gives us. She gives to her children. I think she, really looked at us, played with us, looked under rocks, used telescopes, touched our faces, told us that we were extraordinary, told us that we made her life perfect and remarkable, and those things. So she was very good at making us feel completely immersed in her love when she was with us. And she told us she loved us 1,000 times a day. And it's that sort of same love, I think, that she brought to bear when she looked at the world. She was incredibly enthusiastic about life. She retained, I think, her optimism because she was intent on seeing the beauty and the grandeur of human creation. She focused on the heights to which we could rise rather than the depths to which we often plunged. And she, for instance, with blacksmithing, she looked at it as an art, but she also paid attention to batik. We recently opened up an exhibit of her batik. She looked at ornamental art as a tool of survival as well. These implements of a trade, they reveal so much about a people, and they speak so eloquently about a people. But she saw things like painting and music and things that are simply ornamental, perhaps, as being important because they reveal that aspect of the human soul that makes us pay attention to one another and that can lead to peace.
And yet, at the same time, she was dealing with a difficult marriage. She had gone back to Indonesia to be with her husband, and that didn't work out.
It didn't, no. But again, that's sort of testament to her character. She never lost faith in the possibility of love, even though she had two failed marriages. She really wanted them to succeed. But there were perhaps just too many differences between them, and differences that that she was able to sort of overlook because she saw the beauty of that resided behind each person. But I think that when you sort of take a look at her marriage to my father, what she got out of it was she got, the Indonesian people.
Of course.
Somebody recently has returned to Indonesia. I think it was maybe the London Times. I'm not sure who, actually. But I read that they returned to Qajar and they spoke to many of the families she impacted, and her impact was tremendous, apparently. And everywhere she went in Indonesia, she forged friendships and she engaged in abundant laughter and you know, dared to love so many people. And so for her, the marriage wasn't a failure. It was just a stepping stone. It was something that helped her to open her arms to a broader set of people.
And yet, leaving behind your brother in Hawaii must have been painful for her. What do you remember about those years?
I remember very little. I was 5 or 6 when we left him in Hawaii. And, you know, the truth is that she really didn't have another choice. It was painful, but at that point, he had spent, you know, the previous couple of years in an English language school. He would have been very far behind in Indonesia. They didn't really have the resources to send him to the fancy English language international school. He had made friends in Hawaii. He had become involved in sports. He was happy. And she was entrusting him to her parents with the understanding that we would spend every summer with him, that there would be regular communication, and there were letters written back and forth between the two of them, beautiful letters, which he still possesses, and that we would see him Christmas, and you know, he would travel to Indonesia. And so her feeling was that it was a temporary measure. It was painful, but it would allow him to get the kind of education that would give him the freedom to go anywhere later in life. And she knew that he would matriculate and probably want to go to a university in the United States. And she didn't want to limit his choices later.
And how many years was it before you and she came back to Hawaii?
Quite a number. I mean, we returned
of
every
course,
year,
so you visited.
So I feel like I grew up in Hawaii. We would spend months there, but we returned to live when I was 14 in 1984, and I went to high school in the same high school, again for the same reasons, in essence, because she wanted to make sure that I could go on to a university in the United States and there wouldn't be matriculation difficulties, but also she was ready to work on writing her doctoral dissertation.
What about her views on politically and economically marginalized people? How did they come to shape her work?
Well, I mean, I think that, for instance, in the last part of the dissertation, she talks about suggestions for government and government agencies, but she also reminds everyone that peasants aren't passive, that they are participants in the future of their industry. She writes about the creation of cooperatives, for instance, and she talks about the adaptability of these cultures, for instance, the peasants' willingness to adopt new machine technologies, even though they had been doing, you know, the work the same way for many generations. She revealed that they were actually fairly flexible and open-minded. And I think they taught her a lot about survival and about how to live together and patterns of kinship that could be broad and embracing. I think working with them and having to get to know them made her able to work anywhere in any country, even if she didn't know the language, and to communicate through sort of facial and physical gestures and through emotion. And I don't mean that she was able to communicate the details of her work necessarily. She had interpreters, but I mean that she was able to communicate on those things that reside deeper within a person, and it was what made her good at her job.
So it also perhaps gave her the strength not only to carry on her own work, but to know when the time came, she was going to go back to Hawaii.
Yes, and beyond. So she was going to, I think her plan, she later worked in New York, and her work took her to Ghana and other parts of Africa, including Kenya, I might add. And she also did some work in South America. And I think her hope was that she could bring her understanding of rural peoples and, you know, people who had resided for a long time in the margins of consideration to bear in other places. And I think her intention was to live for a long time and make a positive impact in many places.
Maya Sutero Eng, she is the daughter of S. Ann Dunham, the half-sister of our President Barack Obama. We're talking about her mother's dissertation, which was recently published. It's titled Surviving Against the Odds. Do join us, 800-433-8850, and let's open the phones. At this point, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Clinton, New York. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. And aloha, Maya. My husband and I, actually my whole family, are Kama'aina, who currently live on the mainland, and we have many ties to Hawaii. We first went there through the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii in 1968, and then my husband taught Chinese art history for many years, and our son went to your school and the president's school, Punahou. But my question does go back to university in the East-West Center, and I was just wondering, given all that your mother did in establishing such unique research on Indonesia, and probably from what I understand, sort of as an early pioneer in micro-financing research and observation, I was just wondering if you and your family and the president and his family are in any way involved in the East-West Center in any projects or scholarship funds that would further her interests, her research interests, or perhaps at the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the university?
Well, as it happens, yes. It hasn't been announced, and I'm not sure if I'm the one who's supposed to announce it for the first time, but they are starting a scholarship fund in our mother's name, and it is going to be designed to assist those who are interested in working in Indonesia, but also interested in working within some of the themes that were her passion. And I am on the working committee for the 50th celebration of the East-West Center in Hawaii, and I haven't really started that, but Charles Morrison and I have had a number of interesting conversations, and it's a very special place, and I do hope that across the nation we can have more organizations like the East-West Center where there's real meaningful cultural exchange and where we can begin to help one another to solve the myriad problems we face.
How wonderful. You must be very proud.
I am proud.
I should say.
My brother and my mother.
Tell me about your own work. How did your mother's work influence what you chose as a career?
Well, I'm a teacher. And I think she was a teacher, too. I mean, she did actually teach English for a while to make ends meet in Indonesia. But I also think that she was a teacher all throughout her life, sometimes as a lecturer in the university, but also in sort of this very Socratic way, just by having lots of conversations. Our mother could spend hours and hours talking, you know, words winding themselves through the night and well into the morning.
That's a lovely memory. Maya Suturo Ng. She is the daughter of S.N. Dunham and the half-sister of President Barack Obama. We're talking about her mother's dissertation. It's titled Surviving Against the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut talks about the car accident that changed his life and his music.
You know, I was 18 when I broke my neck. I didn't really have anything to say. It was only after I broke my neck that I really started realizing that I had something to say.
Vic Chestnut on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back as we have a conversation with Maya Suturo Ng. She is the daughter of S.N. Dunham. They both, she and her half-brother, Barack Obama, call her mother. And the dissertation we're talking about was written by Mrs. Dunham. It's titled Surviving Against the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia. Here is a listener's email, one that perhaps will resonate with a great many people around the world. It's from Alexander, who says, I hope Maya will put an end to the speculations that the president was not born in the United States.
I chuckle because I am surprised that there have been so many people who questioned, who have questioned this. I assure you that my brother was born in the Kapiolani Women's and Children's Hospital in Honolulu, Hawaii, on Punahou Street, a few blocks up from where our grandparents helped to raise him. Now, I have been used, actually, in this campaign to sort of set my brother up as the other. When my brother became a senator, I had a student who was perhaps, 15 or 16 years old at the University of Hawaii Laboratory School. It's the adjoining high school. And he interviewed me because it was pretty cool that a local boy had become a U.S. senator. That was a big deal. And so I said, yes, it is. It's wonderful. I said, and he was born just up the road at Kapi'olani Women's and Children's. And Bennett, who is a wonderful young man, I guess made a mistake and said that he was born at Queens, which is also just up the road, perhaps journalistic standards being what they are for 15-year-olds, understandably. And so I have then been placed on hundreds of blogs saying that I have named two different places where my brother was born. And this is all based on a high school newspaper, but it's viewed as proof that we are part of this vast conspiracy. So, not wanting to lend more power to that than already exists out there, I must say, I beg people to please to stop. Don't listen to. Surprise interviews of people who don't speak English in Kenya. Please don't listen to, it's just not true. And it's a tremendous waste of our beautiful nation's energies and resources.
What a beautiful response to a question that, of course, has been zooming around the internet, has created this whole group called Birthers, and to have you sit here and explain that in your own way. Let's go now to Josette, who's in Miami, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Certainly.
I am so pleased to hear this program because so far I have known only about our president's father and grandparents, having read his books, and I am absolutely overwhelmed by the accomplishments of his mother, and I see where he gets his empathy, his curiosity, his moral rectitude. She sounds like such an extraordinary woman. And,
thank you for saying all of that.
No, but it's just, I have wondered, where did this man come from? I admire so many of his characteristics. And it is curious to ask the question, where did a girl from Kansas, am I correct?
That's correct, yes.
Where did that gene come from?
Well, on the one hand, I'm not entirely sure, and I think that that her fertile mind and her instincts and her heart and all the stuff that made her remarkable were things that she sort of birthed on her own. At the same time, our grandmother recently passed away, I think you know, and although our grandparents were very Kansan, after 2000, I lived in Hawaii with our grandmother, and I got to know her, and she was, equally remarkable in her own way. And it wasn't until I spent years with her and watched her survive through episodes of blindness and even though she was physically ailing, her mind was so sharp. And I got to know more of her story from her. that I realized how courageous and strong she was. I mean, they kept moving westward, our grandparents, until they landed in Hawaii after statehood. And our grandmother started working in the bank as a teller and worked her way up in this male-dominated industry to become the vice president of escrow. And I think about Arkansan grandparents, and I think that they worked to make their world broad as well. And they, you know, dared to love our mother in spite of some unorthodox choices on her part. And that was, I guess, unusual for their time.
Indeed. Josette, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For your call. Let's go now to Ralph, who's in Marion, Indiana. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning. Hi, and aloha. I was
aloha.
I was a 25-year resident of Maui, and so
beautiful island.
Yes, it is. So it's changed a lot over the years. So there are many wonderful people there, and it's a very multicultural, multi-ethnic society there in Hawaii. But there's also there are times where there's sort of, at least there used to be, sort of institutional sort of racism and bigotry that people have to deal with at times, and I think that that gave your brother and yourself and your mother most certainly a very unique perspective of being a minority, as it were. And I was, none of that seemed to be covered during or prior to the election. And I was wondering if you had anything to say about that.
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think whenever you have a place where, you know, you had a sort of displaced indigenous population and you had, you're going to basically have lingering tensions. I think there's going to be collisions and contestations and negotiations that have to take place. And you know, when you add into the mix this sort of plantation economy where, you know, with myriad Japanese, Chinese, Filipinos, and Portuguese and others coming, you're going to have an interesting pot, if you will. And what makes Hawaii flavorful is also, I think, what makes it replete with tensions sometimes. And historically, certainly that has been true. But I think that for our family, it is primarily the texture and diversity of the place and the possibility of defining yourself against numerous cultures, peoples, and languages that you know, that gave us freedom, really, to figure out who it is that we are and where our loyalties reside and how we want to shape our lives.
How did you all get to Hawaii when your grandmother and grandfather came from Kansas? Why Hawaii?
I think that our grandfather had a lot of wanderlust, and he was a salesman. He was a insurance salesman and a furniture salesman. He was a brilliant guy. I think that he was probably an underachiever in many respects. He had a near photographic memory, and he had a lot of. He was very gregarious and wanted to see the world and had a great sense of adventure. And so they had spent a little bit of time in California, and I think they had taken some classes and business and other things, and then, of course, Seattle. And here was this kind of this new state, and I think he was intrigued, and he couldn't you know, really contain his excitement, and he elected to make the leap.
How old was your mother when they moved there?
Our mother had graduated early from Mercer Island High School. I think she at the age of 16.
Mm-hmm.
And she had originally wanted to go to, I guess, I don't know if it's Seattle University, but she wanted to go to a university in Seattle. And our grandparents decided that she was too young, even though she was a high school graduate. And so they made her join them in Hawaii. And I think she met Barack Obama Sr. the next year at the age of 17.
And married how soon thereafter?
Very soon thereafter.
Very soon thereafter.
Yeah, I think by the time she was 18. And I don't think she gave her parents a lot of choice. I think that, 18-year-olds will behave rashly. And I think she did. But, you know, good thing. Look what came of it.
And how did the community there in Hawaii look on the marriage between your mother and Barack Obama Sr.?
I don't think that much fuss was made. I mean, it's sort of what I mentioned before. I mean, there were so many people sort of wrestling with issues of identity. And, you know, it's such a layered thing there. There's local versus non-local. And, you know, I just think that they were one of many, many couples who were perhaps regarded as unusual elsewhere, but who were at home there.
And we're talking about a dissertation by President Barack Obama's mother, S. Ann Dunham. It's titled Surviving the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And I think we have time here for a caller in Salt Lake City. Good morning, Gino.
Good morning.
Gino, are you there? All right, let's go to Aaron in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
And my question is, I'm wondering if there's any connection between Ms. Dunham and Catherine Dunham, who is another artist, used her skills and her artistry for social health and well-being.
I don't think so. But, you know, we have had people now, because of my brother, doing a considerable amount of research. And I just learned yesterday that we are distantly related to the Queen herself and McCain and George O'Keefe and, you know, so who knows?
All these relationships do, in fact, come up. How do you keep in touch with the president and his family, your nieces, and the family at large, when I'm sure you are busy and they are extraordinarily busy?
Yeah, they're a good bit busier than I am, I'll say. We're spending a few months here in D.C. It's hard to believe that our time will shortly come to an end. We do not live with them, but we see them every weekend, and it has been a joy and a great gift to us and to my daughters to be able to get to know their cousins, and for me to be able to see my family. Obviously, this is a bit of a strange time, and although the family is dealing with all of these changes and the lack of privacy and so on, with what I consider to be enormous grace and poise, it's good, I think, to have sort of the constancy and the informality of family. So we've spent some time playing Scrabble and taking the girls out on the town without their parents, because the presence of their parents leads to considerable fuss, as you might imagine.
Well, and I'm so sorry you lost your mother at such an early age. You were 25 when she died.
I was, and I thank you. And I think that she would be very happy, and so I would like to say thank you to you today, and then also to Duke University for publishing the dissertation, and to others who participated in making it happen.
Maya Suturo Ng and her mother, Ezan Dunham, the president's mother. Her dissertation is titled Surviving Against the Odds, Village Industry in Indonesia. What a pleasure to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.